The Tom Woods Show, episode 2275.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, chances are if you're listening to this podcast, you are surrounded by irrational, panicked people who think you're a terrible person because you don't want to lock everybody in their houses. No amount of reasoning appears to accomplish anything. And not to mention the media has done nothing but stoke fear and fail to provide context. Well, one of the many benefits you get as a supporter of The Tom Woods Show is membership inside The Tom Woods Show Elite. Recently migrated off Facebook, so if that was holding you back, no longer. This group will keep you sane and informed, and as an added bonus, it won't accuse you of wanting to kill your grandmother. Join me in there at supportinglisteners.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Well, the great Gene Epstein is back with us today. No giggling, Gene. I mean that for real. Absolutely mean that 100% sincerely. Gene,
it's involuntary. Yeah. Go ahead, yes.
Yeah. Well, if I were to go down, you know, I have a handful of guests who, in a way, it's kind of exhausting to have them on because it's like Scott Horton. If I run through everything he has done or is doing, it would just take half the episode. So let's just say Gene Epstein has a resume as long as your arm. Mm-hmm. He's done it all out there in the world. Mm-hmm. I got to know Gene. I guess I got to know you when you were economics and book review editor at Barron's.
Yes.
And we did a debate at the Soho Forum, at Freedom Fest together. And now, in my view, the only debates are Soho Forum. But
well, that's good.
Yes. We did a debate, but not against each other. We were teamed up together.
And it was a blind date.
It was. We hadn't met before, and I didn't know what to expect. And then you were absolutely fantastic. You know, one of these days, because you can find that on YouTube, one of these days, I should probably take your opening statement and paste it into one of these episodes so people can hear what I heard that first day I met you when I was wondering, I don't know, he might be a little establishment. He's with Barron's. And then you gave that rip-roaring opening statement that made mine look like a pussycat had delivered it. I thought, okay.
When I was at Barron's, indeed, even prior to that, when I was at the New York Stock Exchange, I knew I could play practical jokes on people like Tom about this sort of thing. They tend to think that I was at best, you know, free market light rather than being a fanatic. And of course, they'd wonder how the hell does he keep his job that he's such a loudmouth, but partly because I had to play by the rules. So it was fun because I knew I was setting Tom up for a little bit of a shock that I was such an extremist in favor of the free market. So that was fun. Years ago, it was like 12 years ago, 13 years ago. I forget exactly when. Anyway.
Yeah, but it was a wonderful time.
Yeah.
And then some years passed. And then I don't know what happened that you and I became friends to the point where I can't go to New York City without having a meal with you or I feel bad.
Tom stopped by my Barron's office just to chat. And yeah, I guess he was alone, maybe with George. Anyway, it was going past 2 hours and we're still in the middle of talking. We seem to have so much to say to each other that it sort of launched our relationship from there.
Well, one time we had the long talk just alone. Then another time I had a few of my daughters with me and you took them on a little tour of the building. And in fact, I think one of them was able to sit on a Fox Business or Fox News set and get her picture taken. So Veronica won't soon forget that. Well, anyway, the thing you're doing these days is you're director of the Soho Forum, which is just a fantastic debate series in New York City. You can attend in person. You can attend the streaming. You can hear it on the Soho Forum podcast. It's so, so worthwhile. And as people will recall from the previous episode with you, Gene, I have put my money where my mouth is and I have become, you know, I've financially supported the Soho Forum with a little check I gave you.
Well, yeah, and by our standards, it was not a little check. You know, I don't want to be gauche and divulge how many zeros were in the appropriate place, but it was really pretty substantial sum of money. So I just want that recorded. Not a little check at all. Tom really voted with his bucks, with his smackers, as he used to prefer to call fiat money.
And I appreciate it. It's very generous of you to say. Everybody, if you've been listening to the Tom Woods Show for any time whatsoever, you know that when Gene comes on, we talk a little bit. Okay, you can always fast forward over this. There's nothing stopping you. You can fast forward over it. But I do like to hear what he's up to because I really do support it. So what's the next debate coming up at the Soho Forum?
Well, thank you for allowing me to headline that so that, you know, that people who get bored with my spiel a little later on can still hear my announcement. As a matter of fact, it's, so to speak, up your alley, Tom, since you published on the subject. It is going to be about national divorce. And let me read the resolution, which will be defended by Ryan McMakin. Mises Institute senior fellow Ryan McMakin will defend the resolution, the breakup of the United States into different regions. Is a workable option likely to bring a marked improvement in human affairs. He will be opposed by Libertarian Party Classical Liberal Caucus Chair Jonathan Casey. And as viewers of Tom's show know, he has released a book about what otherwise has been called national divorce. So we are going to expose that issue. And McMakin has himself written a book. I think I might have discovered him. It must have been on your show before, hasn't he, Tom, defending his resolution? That position?
Oh, he sure has been on to talk about that.
That's probably how I found him, because part of the benefit of being a regular listener to the Tom Woods show is that it helps me find candidates for debate. And then on top of that, we've inaugurated a new series. A young man named Sam Blankman approached me about this, a sort of Bastiat Society, Soho Forum. You know, the Bastiat Society, which is part of AIER, is groups of people who meet in different localities and discuss free market issues. So should we do a Soul Forum Bastiat Society? And I said, yes, a Bastiat Society in which we discuss the debate. Our most recent one was yesterday, Sunday, and we had the guy, Larry White of George Mason, Lawrence White of George Mason, who had defended the resolution about ending the Fed. So on Thursday evening, we had the debate, Professor Lawrence White of George Mason defending the resolution to end the Federal Reserve against Frederick Mishkin. And indeed, getting Frederick Mishkin was a coup, lucky, dumb luck, because Frederick Mishkin is an establishment guy.
Oh, he's a huge name. Huge, huge name.
Yes. Well, that's right. Exactly. Bob Murphy, our old friend, did a couple of promos for my debate. And he said, hey, I got to tell you, he's getting a textbook. It's quite a coup to get Frederick Mishkin to come to defend the resolution. And as my son Jim said, it sort of adds a sort of respectability to it. Suddenly, the establishment types have got to convince us that you should not end the Fed. That's at least some progress.
That is some progress. By the way, who, just for people who might not know about the Soho Forum, it is Oxford style. So the audience is polled before and after, and we see how they have changed their opinions. Who was declared the winner of the debate?
Oh, well, Mishkin won by 0.4 percentage point. It was a dead heat. They both picked up, Mishkin picked up a little less than 7 points, and Larry White picked up a little more than 6 points. Now, anything within a 5-point range is really just a statistical error. So it was a dead heat. Look, Larry White, I said this to his face at our Bastiat Society salon, he did a solid job. And the debate is getting a lot of views on YouTube. It's also on podcast for those who are curious about it. Did a solid job, but he lacked the fire of a Ron Paul. He lacked the fire of a Tom Woods. He was unable to say, not only should the Fed be abolished because it screws up the economy, it should be abolished because it's evil, because it's an arm of government that prints money to support government financing. The government doesn't like to go to the people and tax us more or borrow. It can just have the money printed. And that's basically something that even small-D Democrats should oppose. So he didn't sort of push the passion. And so it was basically a dead heat. Of course, he did end up with nearly 50% of the vote, and Mishkin ended up with 1/3. By the way, we had a huge attendance, and I believe a good part of it was that the debate was posted at Columbia University. So there were a lot of Mishkinites who showed up. We might have had a little gaming. But in any case, it was a dead heat. It was a tie in terms of Oxford-style voting. But I believe that anybody, even including Tom Woods, could benefit from it. Certainly Larry White and his colleagues are very good historians about the economy, pre-Fed, post-Fed. They really know their data. And I think that's in particular their strength. And they really know basically the idea that the government should not be monopolizing money. So I think it was a successful debate. And again, we are doing our discussions. 20 people showed up at our apartment. My wife fed them and gave them a snack Sunday afternoon. And we grilled Larry, and I gave him the harshest possible criticism of where I felt he went wrong. And I think he was very open to criticism by the kids who were there. I'm going to try to organize the same Bastiat Society salon for our next debate with Ryan McMakin. So that's an extra that we offer. So thanks very much for allowing me to announce that. And that will be, again, I'm looking at the date. It's in late February. It's going to be, I'll find it somewhere. It's going to be in February. I can't find the date. Late February. You'll look it up at the Soul Forum, thesoulforum.org.
All right. Check out thesoulforum.org. It's great. Sure, yeah. Great organization. Yeah. All right. Let's talk about the reason I pulled you onto this episode is a tweet from Mike Cernovich. And it was something along the lines, I don't have it in front of me, but something along the lines of, he says, I went and actually looked at some of the prices that people have to pay for all kinds of goods, whether it's housing or food.
Yeah,
or
whatever. Said, just a moment, Tom. I have extensive notes I prepare for these debates. You sent me his tweet. I didn't find anything other than this one tweet that you sent me, which I'm going to read word for word.
Oh, yeah, please do. Yeah, just read it.
Checking hourly wages, he writes, that he had 20 years ago and inflation adjusting them. Jesus, young people are being screwed. They are making 25 to 35% less in inflation adjusted dollars than we did at their age, from Mike Cernovich. So again, he checked the hourly wages that he had. And then, I don't know, he checks some young people. Obviously, as someone who looks at the official data, I always know that people might be grabbing opinions out of their butts, doing a little bit of anecdotal research, you know, and coming up with a particular observation that's common to people of a right-wing leaning nature, common to people who are libertarian, that things have been going to hell. Things aren't as good as they used to be. And so I looked things up, and I did not find that Mike Cernovich's assertion is supported by the official data.
Well, and of before course, you go into the details of this, I had you on because not just because of that tweet, but because I think in general, there is a consensus among people that something's not right, that you do hear young people saying, I'm never going to be able to afford a house. I'm never going to be able to do all these things that my parents did. And I can't imagine that's entirely anecdotal.
Well, it's not okay. Tom, you know, I've thought about this a lot. I did the research. And
I trust you, Jim. I'm just letting you know where I'm coming from.
Well, Tom, I want to be transparent, Tommy, indeed. And you're gonna help me explain the research that I did. But let's indeed start by the extent to which we can certainly grant the point that you're making. But I want to say as well that very nice of you to compare my resume with Scott Horton's. And what is significant, of course, is that I'm 78. Still doing great at 78, one hopes. And Scott Horton, I think it's about 30 years younger than I, at least. So, and all that means by being 78 is I've been a little bit around the block. And my generation was also supposed to be doing awfully as well. I'm actually even too old to be a baby boomer. I was born in November 1944. You have to be born in 46 to be a baby boomer. But of course, I'm a little bit like a year ahead of the baby boomers, and we were supposed to be impoverished compared to our parents, and that myth, after a while, sort of died out, and now the young people are impoverished compared to us. So it's an old refrain, but okay, it's an old refrain, but clearly, we needn't belabor the point that college costs have gone through the roof, and a lot of young people do go to college, and they're paying through the nose for something pretty worthless, and many of them are paying off pretty substantial debts to pay off that college. And of course, we talked about government bailing them out. You and I actually had a session about this. I refer people to a Tom Woods show in which Tom and I discussed this issue. So we want to grant Tom that they're paying huge debt. They're facing that. Although I will cut to the chase with respect to home ownership, Tom, and say only that I used a simple metric. I compared rates of home ownership in the past with older people and rates of ownership in the present with that of older people. And I find that home ownership rates have actually declined, but they've declined uniformly across age groups up to age 55. You follow me? In other words, you can look up home ownership rates in 10-year intervals like 45 to 54, 35 to 44, and the declines are about flat. As a matter of fact, this is funny. I found that for the 20 to 24-year-olds, home ownership rates have not declined. Now, obviously, the extent to which they own a home is much less in the 20% range, but it's about what it was in the late 1990s. So, I don't know, is that point clear statistically, Tom?
Yes, that point is clear.
Okay. So, therefore, again, I will say that I was a little surprised to find that all the age breakdowns on the data do not bear out the point made by Mr. Cernovich, because it's definitely true that, for example, if you look at European countries where there are age breakdowns, you find that the young really are being shafted disproportionately. And of course, in an economy where the labor markets get really structured so that it's difficult to enter an economy that's slowed down, of course, the new entrants are the ones who get hurt especially hard. And so one would have expected that. And yet, I can't find it in the data. And I think we should go over a few numbers. So I anticipated the data because you asked about home ownership, Tom. But let me back up again and say that, of course, right now, it's difficult for a first-time buyer to buy a home because mortgage rates have come down, but they're still pretty high. So the cost of entry is high. As mentioned, of course, a lot of them are bearing the burden of student debt. And that hurts because, indeed, certainly the cost of college is sky high compared to what it was even in your day, Tom. And you're an old man of 50. I'm an old man of 78. We know that. And then, of course, furthermore, the point that's been made by so many, like Lawrence Kotlikoff, is that the young people are paying for the Medicare and for the Social Security of the older people. But all you have to do is cite the Congressional Budget Office and show that they are paying for something that they're not going to get when they come of age. Something has got to give. It certainly is not, but the U.S. budget will not be able to sustain the cost of Social Security and Medicare when these young people come of age and are eligible for it. So they're being hurt in that way as well. Is there anything else you might be able to mention that sort of like is beyond dispute about how young people are being hurt, Tom? I tried to cover the general territory. What would be your point? Anything else that you can think of?
Well, I haven't looked at any of the numbers. I'm just saying we've all heard this narrative to the point where it's kind of taken for granted by most people. And even some free market people, I think, feel somewhat weirdly demoralized. Like we can't argue for the free market anymore, or we have to talk about other issues because it's just yielding an embarrassing result.
Okay, Tom, that's interesting. That's interesting, the way you just put it. Let me recommend, I did a debate with New York Times editorial writer Benjamin Applebaum. And as a matter of fact, the sound, the volume of that debate on YouTube came in rather low. You need a good amplifier for it, but certainly it's good on a podcast. The sound came well there, but I think you can listen to it on YouTube. In that particular case, he was talking about the disappointing performance of the U.S. economy, and he blamed it on the free market. And again, you talk about the free market is failing us. And obviously, that gets me a little bit bothered to hear even Tom Woods repeat that point as though there's even some plausibility to it. The fact of the matter is the rise of restrictive licensure on the part of states, the rise of that kind of crony capitalism, the difficulty becoming a beautician, moving to low-wage jobs, and in particular, something that has been emphasized over and over again with very solid research, low-earning people cannot move to high-wage areas because of the housing costs. Because in those high wage areas, the housing costs are sky high. Those of us with advanced degrees can afford the housing costs and take advantage of the high wage jobs. But those who earn median or less cannot afford it. And this is, of course, a point made by Ed Glaser of Harvard and so many others. And that's, of course, the policy of government. And they're sticking around the low wage areas. So again, the problem with respect to inequality is that to the extent that we have it and can object to it, can be laid at the door of the rise of the progressive state. And so, again, it's not the failure of the free market. It's clearly a failure of the progressive state to the extent that it's happening. And that's why, by the way, that's another reason, because you do see some widening inequality with respect to wages, but I don't see it broken down by age. That surprised me a little bit. And again, to the extent that you see it, estimates have been made about the huge degree to which the intervention in the housing market has made it impossible for labor to move. There have been studies of this particular issue. And of course, the difficulty of labor to move where labor earns around the median income or less. If you move to a high wage area and you get a job, you know, as a software engineer or any kind of skilled work, then of course you can afford to do that move. And so that's the outrage of those who talk about inequality and blame it on the free market. That's the main principal point I made against Benjamin Applebaum's argument about widening inequality. So now you mentioned the free market people, Tom. Look, so many of the free market people I encounter over the years are indeed pessimists, and they do indeed, I think, underestimate the extent to which the market actually is still coping, is still managing to deliver for people. I'll tell you something else funny, Tom, is that we have an after party that my wife throws now at our apartment after each debate. Should have mentioned that. You not only go to the debate on Thursday night, but you come over to our place two blocks away for a party. And the party starts around 8:30 after the debate ends. And by at 11 o'clock, I decide I've got to start kicking these young people out. And of course, if you meet all the young people who come to our debates, people under 35, you get the opposite impression. They seem to make it look easy. They all have high-paying jobs. But obviously, that's a self-selected group. So I get a wrong impression just by talking to all the young people who come to my parties. But again, Tom, it's... Tom, you're still there, right?
I'm still here. I just listen to Gene Epstein. I sit at his feet.
Okay, Tom. But anyways, Tom, have I convinced you that there is a huge degree of inequality that can be laid at the door of government intervention? The rise of restrictive licensure, especially with respect to jobs that pay median wages, and the ever-tightening housing market. The only thing heartening is, by the way, that even Binyamin Applebaum and Ezra Klein and others are beginning to rebel about housing. They don't connect the dots completely. They don't realize how the housing problem in localities like New York City shafts low-wage workers, but there is some hope that they'll begin to understand that as well. They just don't like the high cost of housing, and they recognize that government is the problem in that regard. So you accept that, right, Tom, so far?
Yes. Well, sure. Yeah, I do.
Can't lay it to the free market, Tom? Oh. Do I have you an agreement on that point?
You do have my agreement on that. But
Okay. Yes, go ahead.
Let me just ask you, let's say we're not implicating the free market at all. We're just speaking about people's experiences. And we surely would say that a younger person today entering the job market is at the very least entering a very different environment than somebody entering it 40 years ago. That person is highly unlikely, again, based entirely on anecdotal evidence. I haven't looked at any of the data, but is highly unlikely to be at that with that same firm 50 years later and have a big retirement party.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
So would you say that their employment situation is nevertheless more precarious?
Oh, okay. Yeah, Tom, that's see, now, Tom, you're responding to me because let me just say that I think I should go over some of the data, but let me just say that the Bureau of Labor Statistics does indeed keep consistent data for younger age groups. I wrote you that I was focusing on the 20 to 35-year-olds. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has data for 20 to 24-year-olds and then for 25 to 34-year-olds. So I define young as 20 to 35. There is data on the teenagers, 16 to 19, and I have... I can report a little bit about that, but I thought it was less interesting since many of them are betwixt and tween in high school, so it gets a little complicated there. But I want to go over that data. But then once I looked at that data, I began to say to myself, well, what can we say that's fairly clear about young people getting shafted? I went over a few of the points just earlier, and then I asked you earlier, what else can you mention, Tom? You're mentioning something. I'm sure that I haven't looked it up, and I think there's been some debate, but I'm sure you're right that employment is less stable than it used to be. You know, you're going 40 years back into the early 1980s. I'm sure you're right about that. And so that's true too. Employment is less stable. But I have mixed feelings about that a little bit, Tom. And of course, probably it's just my personal bias. You know, I bounced around. Part of the reason why you're impressed with my resume, Tom, is that I couldn't keep a job for that long. Well, I did okay. I was at the New York Stock Exchange for nearly 14 years, and then things got bad for me, and I was betwixt in between, and then I got the job with Barron's. That was for 26 years. I left Barron's in January of 2018 when I was 73. So, and then prior to the New York Stock Exchange, I had been director of commodity research, but none of those jobs lasted for me, Tom. And the point is that, is it really so wonderful to be stuck in the same job with the same company for 50 years? I guess it's got its virtues, but not for everybody, right, Tom? Many of us could use a change. And of course, it's disruptive and a little bit upsetting. All I'm really saying, Tom, is that it depends on your subjective view, but I will grant at the end of the day that there are people who like to have the same job 50 years. They feel better doing that. It's probably mainly, by the way, people for whom a job is just a job. And I respect those people. The ideal point about a job is that it's the way you support your family. And what could be a better goal than that? Supporting your family, seeing your kids grow up, providing for them, being a provider. So that's great. And if you keep the same job 50 years, it's wonderful. So, all right. So that too is a way in which young people do not have the same advantages we had. But of course, they're a little bit too young to get fired. But I guess, come to think of it, I guess you and I could say that in the Great Recession of 2008-09, many of them who were young, you know, did get shafted. They lost their jobs. So that's bad. Some instability there, and they will probably look forward to more instability in the future. That's true, too. You have to scramble around to get another job. So we've covered all the ways in which they're doing worse. And maybe, Tom, I should cut to the chase and talk about all the ways in which they are not, at least the particular way in which they are not participating. Maybe I should do that. What is that all about? That's about labor force participation rates. And if I look at men, not women, that's interesting. If I look at the men 20 to 24, and if I look at the men 25 to 34, I find that, and Tom, I use the late 1990s as my base, but I could use the 80s as well, but use the late 1990s because that was more or less the perspective of Mike Cernovich because he went back 20 years ago. That's what he mentioned was going back 20 years ago. But we could go back to the 80s and it would be the same story. The labor force participation rate of men 25 to 34 has plummeted from the late 1990s. It's plummeted from the 80s. The labor force participation rate of men 20 to 24 has plummeted as well. And how would you interpret that, Tom? I'll put you in that seat.
Well, I was going to ask you, how do we account for this? And it's not COVID. So how do we account for it?
Well, I don't think it's because they are legitimately discouraged about getting employment, even though I would grant that it's a little demoralizing. In that particular case, I would begin to point out that the restrictive licensure has made it a little bit difficult just to become a manicurist or to become a barber or to work in a funeral home. I don't think that the excuse can be that the economy has been buffeting them. I think that many of them simply lack incentives. I think that there are men between the age of 25 and 34 who are on disability because there was a big revolution in disability. The book called Men Without Work, which is written by, and why am I forgetting the name of the guy from American Enterprise Institute, he did an update of his Men Without Work book post-COVID. And again, he's finding that a lot of them are sort of hibernating, scraping together, not really in the job market, working in the cash market, living off their parents. Obviously, you're not going to get anywhere in life in terms of what the capitalist economy can offer you unless you get a job. And so we are talking then about the failure of this generation to some degree. I mean, I don't want to overemphasize the point. Well, what's my figures here? Men aged 25 to 34. Their labor force participation rate recently was 88.5%. That means nearly one out of 12 is not in the labor force. And as recently as the late 90s, it was 93.5%. So it's gone down by 5 percentage points. Here we have a situation in which there is an abundance of jobs and they're not in the labor force. What's interesting about women is that their labor force participation rate rose into the 90s and is pretty much plateaued. It has not declined. It's stable. Women in those age groups, their labor force participation rate is still lower than that of men, but it's not down from the late 1990s. It's about where it was in the late 1990s. So again, really, the main takeaway is that to the extent that the official trends show us something that is disconcerting, it's that the labor force participation rate of men 20 to 35 is down from the late 90s. Actually, for 20 to 24-year-olds, it's a little bit ambiguous. You could say, I don't know, maybe some of them, more of them were back in school than were or getting some kind of training. Their labor force participation rate recently is 72%, and it's down from 82% in the late 90s, down by 10 percentage points. And I don't think it's because there's a lack of available jobs. So in a way, that's the most striking bit of numbers that speaks to us. but I want to shift now to some of the other numbers, but maybe you want to summarize, Tom, because we've been throwing around a lot of points here. Any observation you want to make about what we've learned so far?
Well, no, other than, in a way, it kind of reminds me of when people talk about there being too many people in the world.
Yeah.
And you can find people in the ancient world saying there were too many people in the world. You know, this is a complaint that has been around as long as time. And so likewise, when you say, oh, this generation has it the worst, or when people say the world is in the worst condition it's ever been in, and then you look back and basically everybody's always said that. Now, by the way, that doesn't mean it's false. It really could be that when they said it 500 years ago, it really was the worst. You know, who knows, right? But in this case, though, I guess the reason I wanted to talk to you about it was because I know you dig into the data. So you rely on the data. I rely on Gene Epstein. That's how this relationship works. And I keep reading these heart-wrenching anecdotal accounts of my life is aimless and I can't get out of this debt that I'm in. Now, I'll grant you that the student, I don't make any defenses of the student loan program that put them in that situation, but I'm in this hopeless dead-end job and whatever. I mean, you just hear this constantly that I have to move back in with my parents. And I get that people have always complained about that. It just seems like it's more now.
There's a bit of data I want to mention about that, but then you come to think of it, you do inspire another point with respect to how we can say that young people are suffering. It's very possible that the zeitgeist is depressing young people, taking away some of their pluck. And of course, the zeitgeist being mainly the idea that the earth is frying up because of global warming. And, you know, the human beings are going to perish as a result of the fact that the temperature is going to go up by another 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit. So maybe that's part of it as well. I want to actually come to think of it back and fill another point. With respect to those secure jobs, a lot of the past, a lot of that security was in manufacturing, as I imagine you must know, Tom. And then, of course, you know that the mantra of left-wingers and of the progressives was, of course, that that's where, you know, people are on the assembly line and that's where life is so alienating. And now manufacturing jobs are plummeted and the jobs are in other areas. And we're supposed to mourn, I guess, the loss of those manufacturing jobs that were getting people so demoralized. But let me also then say, so we got maybe depression is greater. I find that it's difficult to believe all these studies about greater depression because it's hardly news that if you're looking for greater depression, you'll find it. And 30, 40 years ago, researchers weren't really looking for depressed people the way they were. I haven't checked, come to think of it. Maybe, of course, the major index of depression is suicide. And of course, suicide even then is difficult.
But I don't necessarily mean clinical depression. I just mean a feeling of hopelessness.
Well, yeah, okay. No, okay, exactly. By the way, I completely buy the idea. Clinical depression is indeed bad, but I'm just saying that it's a little bit along a continuum. And maybe the feeling of hopelessness is better put than depression, because maybe, again, you know, if you consume the corporate media too much, then I guess you're going to be depressed because, you know, again, because bad things are happening. Global warming in particular is happening. I keep calling it global warming, even though they call it climate change. So that's depressing. But then let me back up one point, which I was going to begin with, which is that debatable point. And now we're going to get a little bit into the data and hopefully spend a little time on the actual data with respect to earnings. But this is a key finding in contrast to what Mike Cernovich showed. If I look at a particular series that I trust, that I think is better than any other, which is called, by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Median Usual Weekly Earnings of Full-Time Wage and Salary Workers. In other words, they are talking about people who do work full-time and what they usually earn when they work full-time. And why do I emphasize that? Because I find that a lot of progressives and left-wingers are, I know they're throwing around data about hourly wages. I just tweeted about that. I don't know where they find this data that recently reported that 32% of the working population earns $15 an hour or less. And all I said was that, well, presumably you're talking about people who work full-time. And of course, a lot of people work part-time. They work sporadically. We're talking about people who just usually work full-time. In other words, they're actually participating in the labor force in the way that we imagine people do. You know, you put them in a 35 to 40-hour week. And so that's why I wanted to focus on that data. So what I found is that if you apply any of the price indexes to the usual weekly earnings of people earning 20 to 24, people who are aged 20 to 24, sorry, or people who are aged 25 to 34, you find that in real terms, as of the fourth quarter of 2022, they were all earning a peak amount. It was at a record high. In other words, again, if you use the conventional price indexes, either the CPI or if you use what I actually think is a better price index, is the personal consumption expenditures deflator, which is a price index, either one, you will find that what they're earning is at a record high. So that now, of course, obviously, we would then have to get into a huge debate about whether the price index is valid. And of course, the price indexes for young people don't include the cost of student debt. So I would grant that to that extent, they're getting hurt. But of course, a lot of these kids didn't go to college. Many of them don't have such high student debt, but that's bad, the student debt part. So you get that point. In other words, what I'm saying is that if you want to argue that the price indexes are screwed up, and of course, a lot of libertarians I know, free market people, do believe that they are. I actually believe that on balance, they probably overstate price inflation to some degree, but that would get us down a rabbit hole, a long discussion in itself. That could be an interview for another time. But I'm always saying that we do find that young people who usually work full-time are earning in real terms more than young people ever did in real terms. So we've established that. Now, we could say, however, that, of course, the economy's growth has slowed since the year 2000, since the late 90s. And so the progress is slower. The progress has been slower for young people than it was for Tom Woods when he was starting out in the early 90s, or slower when I was starting out. You know, I came of age, obviously, I started to work in the 1970s after screwing around a bit. So progress is slower, the growth is slower, but they are at record highs. So that does directly contradict Mike Cernovich's point that if you adjust for inflation, then making 25 to 35% less in inflation-adjusted dollars, because I don't think Mike Cernovich knows how to look these things up. But if you do look it up, then that's what's being reported. They are making a peak amount. Now, but the same strategy I used, Tom, when you and I talked about the share of income that goes to workers in general. And you elaborated very nicely on the point about how if you track nominals with nominals year by year, you don't have to worry about price indexes. You get decent trending ratios. So this is what I did. For earnings, what I did was I asked, take the earnings of 45 to 54-year-olds, the weekly earnings of full-time 45 to 50-year-olds. Take those earnings back from the late 90s to the present, those earnings. Now take the earnings, let's take the largest group, of the 25 to 34-year-olds back to the early, from the late 90s through the present. And if you got the result that young people are being shafted, you would have expected that the marginal difference, the difference between the earnings of the people who are 45 to 54, of course, they're going to be earning more than the people who are 25 to 34 would have widened. Of course, they're going to be earning more in all cases, but has the ratio changed? You see the question I'm asking? Well, I found that, and let me see if I can give you the actual number. Let's see, 3 to 4 times. Where did I have it? Well, I'll report in qualitative terms. I wrote down too many numbers. I found that the ratio between the younger age groups and the middle-aged age group from the late 90s to the present has remained the same. Did you hear my point there, Tom?
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
Yeah. Oh, actually, this is the thing that I'm not going to be able to explain. I did take it back. The ratios go through this from the 70s to the 80s to the 90s. You know what I found? I found that from the 70s to the 80s, that's when the older people pulled ahead. You get it? In other words, the 70s, there was a certain ratio between the young and the old. And then I found that the ratio widened into the 80s. And I found that if you wanted to say that young people, you know, matter of fact, I guess that's plausible because I guess that's when factory jobs were dying. And so the young blue-collar workers were not moving it to some of those high-wage union jobs. That's when the jump occurred. But from the 80s to the 90s into the present, the ratio between the earnings of the middle-aged men and women and the earnings of the middle of the younger people, 20 to 24 and 30 or 25 to 34, the ratio has remained pretty much the same. Of course, when you look at this data, you want to adjust for business cycles. So if we take it from the late 90s to the present, late 90s is when the unemployment rate was low, it's easy enough to scan. It's easy enough to show that there really has been no change since the early 80s in the ratio between the salaries of the middle-aged versus the younger people. And so now I also took unemployment rates. So again, the question would be, well, younger people are probably, if they're out of work, they're having more difficulty getting a job. And again, I found no change. I found that indeed, of course, the unemployment rate of those 20 to 24, in terms of the trend from, actually, I took it back to the late 1940s. I'll tell the whole story. Take the unemployment rate of those 20 to 24 and the unemployment rate of those 45 to 54 as the base. Compare it then with the unemployment rate as well of those 25 to 34, you find that by the 1970s, that's when it got worse for the younger people. You find that younger people always had, even back to the late 1940s, a higher rate of unemployment than the middle-aged people, 45 to 54. And I'll tell you something interesting about the unemployment rate across age groups is that you would guess, if I would ask you, why is it even when labor markets were probably functioning fairly well in the late 40s, 50s, early 60s, the unemployment rate among younger people was higher? Of course, they are less experienced and they will be the first to be fired by firms that are contracting. And so they will always have a higher unemployment rate, even though, by the way, one of the reasons why there is a certain modification in unemployment rate of people from 45 to 54, which is something I encountered a while back, which was very meaningful for a while there, is that the older people spend a longer time looking for a new job. They spend more time unemployed than the younger people. The younger people come in and out. They jump. The older people stick around. But that's a complicated digression. My only point is that from the 70s to the present, the ratio between the unemployment rate of the younger people and of the older people has remained the same. No difference. So there too, what I'm doing then is taking nominals over time, nominals with respect to income over time between the older and the younger, nominals over time between, so to speak, between unemployment rates of the younger and the older. And I find that the ratios have been the same. So that's the basic story. And then the only disconcerting thing I find is that maybe the younger people are depressed. There's something going on that's disconcerting, although it's been going on for a long time. And I think it has a lot to do with the rise of disability payouts, the rise of the welfare state. The younger people are not participating in the labor force the way they used to. And that's obviously quite disconcerting, because if you don't try to get a job, you're not going to get anywhere in life.
Hey folks, quick sponsor message. If you're like me, you feel like no sooner have you completed one meal when somehow already it's time to prepare the next one. Well, what if you had a nice big bundle of juicy, tender, and flavorful Omaha steaks at the ready? My family's been ordering from Omaha Steaks since probably around the time of the first Ron Paul presidential campaign. Super convenient, great value, and absolutely delicious. They have everything from perfectly aged tender steaks to juicy burgers, decadent desserts, classic comfort meals, everything you need for a romantic Valentine's Day dinner, for a whole bunch of people coming over to watch a game, or even just for a regular weekday night. Every time you order from Omaha Steaks, you are getting five generations of family-owned expertise. Not to mention, steak is fast becoming the most politically incorrect meal there is, so that's all the more reason to stock up on Omaha Steaks. Plus, with this special offer, visit omahasteaks.com and enter Woods at checkout to get $30 off your order. So do what the Woodses do. Stock up on Omaha Steaks. Go to omahasteaks.com and use promo code Woods at checkout to get an extra $30 off your order. You're already saving up to 55% on select Omaha Steaks customer favorites, but now you can save an extra $30 off your order when you go to omahasteaks.com and use promo code Woods at checkout. Minimum order may be required. Another statistic would be, now this is from a few years ago, 2019, I doubt it's changed much.
Yeah.
CBS News, or I guess drawing from Money Watch, ran a headline saying, more millennials are living at home than at any other time this century. And they say it's 22%. Yeah, yeah. And they say that this is because of student loan debt, rising rents, and stagnant wages.
Yeah. Well, good, Tom. You know, there is census data about that. I don't think it's for 2022. And I didn't look that up. I would imagine it's still the case. It certainly would help explain what these younger people are doing who have no jobs. For example, as I mentioned to you, it was 82% labor force participation of men aged 20 to 24, and now it's down to 72%. So that's a 10 percentage points of decline. And I would imagine that many of them are living at home, as we say, or with their parents. But of course, the fact that you're living at home with your parents doesn't mean you can't get a job. It might be a good idea for you to get a job, you know, then it's less important to pay your own bills because your parents are helping to pay the bills. But they're obviously, I guess, home listening to podcasts maybe, or, you know, the Tom Woods show or whatever else they're doing. Again, the book is called Men Without Work, so you can find it. And he said they're basically home watching television or watching screens or, I guess, trolling the internet. They're not doing a whole lot. But of course, again, these Money Watch sources and all the rest of them, those people don't know how to. If I ask them to try to find just on the government websites this data, I don't think they could find it. Now, by the way, the government websites are not very user-friendly. I have the advantage of Haver Analytics data, and of course, I've been covering the data for more than 30 years, so I know where to find numbers, but I don't think any of them know how to find their numbers. They probably plagiarize from each other. Who knows, they're probably all plagiarizing from Mike Cernovich, who did his research by checking, I don't know what, you know. All I'm saying is there's so many empty claims being made about the data. But going back to your point about the young people living at home because they're depressed or because they have student loan debt, I'm sure there's a lot to that. You do have census data on that, and they probably found that. And I would imagine that that's still the case, although it does not mean that you can't get a job. You know, it should mean that you don't have to be as picky with respect to how much the job pays. You can look forward possibly to investing in yourself and developing talents. Maybe you could get an internship, you know, or whatever that pays little or nothing, but gives you useful experience. And apart from that, there are plenty of jobs available in the economy, even right now, even though, who knows, we might be moving into a recession. But I grant your point in feeling what you said, the feeling of hopelessness, the feeling that nothing is worth it. Obviously, I know I've got several friends whose kids are having trouble with substance abuse. So that too has been happening. So I don't mean to build a rosy picture, I guess, but the punchline, however, is that one of the takeaways is that at least in terms of the official data, if you're a young person who's not hopeless, then the jobs are out there. If you're a young person who's not hopeless, then the salary you're likely to get for the job that you can get will be about the same in relation to what the older people get today as it was in the 1980s and 90s. You're not being left behind, at least according to the official data. And I don't particularly see how the official data are necessarily mistaken about this. These are just approximate numbers, and they've been true consistently now for the past few decades. So that's the good news. There are opportunities out there. Things aren't nearly as bad as Mike Cernovich says. However, again, the economy has slowed, progress has slowed, so that's affecting everybody across the board. But you're not being significantly shafted in relation to the older people, unless, of course, you have a crushing amount of student debt.
All right. Well, as we depart here,
yes,
I'm going to ask you something that I know what your answer is. It's that I don't want to spend my golden years doing this, but
what?
The thing is, you do have an ability to go into the data and grab it for us, and most people don't, and you're right, most people are just relying on data that other people dug out to the extent they're relying on data at all.
Yeah.
And yet you tell a very different story about a lot of things, like you did a debate with Dan McCarthy on this show about tariffs, and I thought you had a very strong performance there. So you're very good at marshaling data to undermine long-standing narratives that you believe to be false. So it seems like you could write a great book saying, look, everybody, all you people don't understand anything. But do you want to do that, right? There'd be a lot of charts and, you know, do you want to spend your time that way?
Tom, I really do. I did write a book of sorts about that, published in 2006. Called
Right, but I mean, since then, a lot of other things have developed.
Oh, yes, indeed. Oh, yeah. Of course. I'm just saying that I did. You're talking about somebody who liked the idea. And the answer, Tom, is I do like the idea. I told him, I've slowed down a bit. I'm actually suffering from some kind of something that's slowing me down. And I've been searching a sort of tremor that makes it difficult for me to get a whole lot of work done. And I have the ambition to do precisely that. I have a sufficient humility, Tom, to understand that I might be good at different things. But as you indicate, why not have the humility to know, well, if this is your, I know, am I going to use the word comparative advantage correctly? Probably not. Your absolute advantage. If this is something that you have a lot of experience with and you can do well, and indeed, I believe I can do it well, I post a lot of single line charts, simple charts that don't intimidate. I'm with you all the way on that, Tom. Again, because I don't need to write the ultimate book about libertarianism. I don't need to pontificate about the world. Tom Woods does that at least as well as I do it. A lot of other people do it extremely well. So what's my special niche? Precisely what you say, Tom. If I can get up the energy, if I can get over a recent ailment that I'm getting some help with, then I might very well accept your assignment. As it is, at least I get a chance to talk about it on your show. As you know, I did a presentation down the Mises Institute with data, and I do release, I get access to very good database of handling. So I do it to some degree, and I do feel that that's indeed what I should be doing. So the answer is absolutely, Tom, as long as the answer is yes to your assignment, as long as I can muster up the energy and the time.
All right. Well, I totally hear you.
Yeah.
I was thinking if I had this knowledge, it would come out as an ebook. But I don't.
As an ebook. Well, no. Of course, look, the ebook is a great mechanism. And God, you, Tom, you contribute. You will go down in history. You are the guy who read Bob Murphy, by the way, is another guy, another Austrian guy who knows the data very well. And of course, you maintained a great show with Bob for years called Contra Krugman. I was initially groaning. I devoted 5 chapters to Krugman in my own book. And I thought, who wants to talk about this guy anymore? But you and Bob showed that you could actually teach a lot of lessons and you could do a deep dive into data that, of course, Bob mainly did. And then you read Bob's collection of pieces, Contra Krugman, which again is an audible book that I highly recommend, and a book I recommend. So you've been part of this. You've been helping to midwife this, and of course, helping to sponsor what I do. So indeed, I would, when you say you release it as an ebook, of course, I would release it in all formats, and I would want to make it an audible book, and of course, spread the word. I'm less interested in making money than in spreading the word. I mean, I've been thinking, because we're talking about your personal advice. I take advice from you, Tom, because you have blazed a trail with respect to your career. Here you have a BA from Harvard and a PhD from Columbia, 2 strikes against you, and yet you've been a really successful entrepreneur in this field. So, of course, I would take your advice. And
I think you would publish it traditionally. I'm just thinking that at this point, I'm all done publishing books, so I just release everything as an ebook. I don't want the rigmarole. I don't want the promotion work.
Limiting it to ebooks. You meant limiting it. Yeah, no. All I meant was, of course, I thought you were just. I would, of course, just want to use all formats.
Yeah, use all form. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You should. And incidentally, as you say, I narrated Bob's book Contra Krugman.
Yeah.
And in that case, that's a book like your proposed one that we're talking about had a lot of charts in it.
Yeah. Yes.
But I think the narration went to show that you could still. You don't really need the charts to get the point of the text. It just backs up what the text is saying.
No, that's precisely.
So it's okay if people are listening and there's no visual.
Yes. Yeah, no, indeed. You did a superb read through of that book, and I highly recommend you read through. And of course, you get the point. Although, of course, obviously, the chart sort of hits you viscerally. It is kind of a war paint. And at least we're reassured as you're reading the book that the chart is there, the data is there, and the source can be traced. So we have, we accept the authority of what Bob is saying. Look, Tom, I was just imagining as the next step, sort of a Substack in which I could start, releasing this kind of data, and then maybe that would add up to a book. All of that I found recently hitting me. I'll tell you, personally, I left Barron's literally 5 years ago this month at the age of 73, and I did articles. I was looking forward to doing long-form articles and so on, and I had a pretty good output. And now I find that over the last 2-3 years, I actually have slowed down. and at the age of 78. And so I've got to see if I can pick up the pace. So that's my only answer. I've been wallowing in self-pity about that. But again, I appreciate your suggestions, Tom. And certainly that is very good advice about how I can inform people, how my particular niche in which I can inform people about the world. That why not play from what you're best at rather than try to play in other people's sandboxes about what else you do. And of course, obviously, the soul form is clearly something I'm going to continue to do. I want to just shift to one question for you, Tom. Do you plan to go up to Porkfest this coming?
No, I have so much travel I want to do with my kids this summer that it's just not in the plans.
Okay. I was curious about that. I'm going to be hosting, just wanted to plug that because in order to go to Porkfest, you have to buy your tickets pretty much in advance to get hotel reservations. And I will be up there again at Porkfest, pretty much going up there on the Tuesday. It's like the last week. It starts on the 19th of June and it goes through the 25th. And it's up at Lancaster, New Hampshire. And there are hotels. But of course, you can camp out on the grounds there, as some young people do. And I will be doing a debate myself with David Friedman. I'll be debating him. That's the illustrious son of Milton Friedman, a brilliant guy. We will be debating the usefulness of the non-aggression principle. David actually believes the non-aggression principle is too flawed to ever use in any argument about libertarian solutions to the world. And I want to debate him on that particular topic. And then I will be hosting a debate between Jeremy Kaufman and Matt Kibbe. And Jeremy Kaufman, as you may know, is part of very much a spokesman for the Free State Project. And they tend to believe that libertarianism is a limited, is an acquired taste, acquired only by those people who have the genes for it, and that you pretty much want to give up on spreading the word of libertarianism to most people. You basically want to just concentrate your energy by having people move to the free state. And so Matt Kibbe is more hopeful about spreading the word of libertarianism. And so that's going to be another soul form debate we have up there. And I just wanted to plug it now because it sells out pretty quickly and the hotel and the accommodation is going to sell out pretty quickly. And I wanted all you viewers to know about that. And I have a great time up there. You've been up there a few times, haven't you, Tom?
Yep, yeah. Twice. Yep.
Yeah. This will be my third time. And, you know, it's funny about as you slow down, right, or this particular malady and a tremor that I have, when I do the soul form or I have the receptions or when I'm at a place like Porkfest, there's some kind of galvanic energy that takes over me, and I'm a different person. But obviously, that's a kind of a drug that can't last long. And if you're going to do a book or do a series of articles, then it's a different experience. Anyway, I just wanted to plug Porkfest, and I hope a lot of viewers buy the tickets to Porkfest. You'll find it as well on the website, and then go into thesohoforum.org. And you'll find, by the way, I'm also personally doing the debate in May at my Soul Forum and the debate in February, which of course Tom Woods fans would be especially be interested in, will be the debate about the national divorce at thesoulforum.org.
All right. Well, thank you, Gene. Porkfest is Porcupine Freedom Festival. You can look that up and see if you, I don't even know if they sold out early last year. I don't know what the status is, but you can check it out, Porcupine Freedom Festival. And then of course, the most important link of all, thesohoforum.org. Gene Epstein will be there in New York City, second week of April. So we'll have to arrange to get together again.
Oh, you're going to be in town?
Yeah, we're making another trip up to NYC. So we'll catch you when we're there.
You'll be there with Jenna. That's great. Okay.
Yeah.
I want to plug, you know, that perhaps you know, Tom, that the play that goes wrong is still playing in New York City. You know, it's such a great play. You've seen it almost 10 times. And those who want to get an insight into the mind and heart of Tom Woods, you get to know him better if you see a play that he can't get enough of, the play that goes wrong. And do you have tickets to that sequel, Peter Pan Goes Wrong? Is that, you already bought tickets to that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that Peter Pan Goes Wrong might have actually come first, but it doesn't matter. They had never performed it in the U.S. before, only in London. So It's great to have a chance to go see it.
You're saying that Peter Pan Goes Wrong was the first play and the play that goes wrong is like the sequel? Is that right?
Yeah, I believe it is. I'm not entirely sure of that, but certainly the play that goes wrong came to the U.S. first.
Yes, well, that's interesting.
And then I looked up this old one and sure enough, they're doing it on Broadway. So that's partly why we're, We have a few reasons to come to New York in April, but one of them is I love every play that the Mischief Theater produces.
Yes.
And the original Broadway cast is going to be there, and I'm looking forward to that. So we'll figure out some restaurant we have not been to yet, Gene. We'll eat there.
The play that goes wrong is still playing on off-Broadway on West 50th Street at the New World Stages. So those who want to see it at least once, you can see that plus Peter Pangold. You have a double feature if you come to New York City. I saw the play that goes wrong once, and I thought once was enough. It was certain. I certainly recommend it. Tom couldn't get enough of that play. So just want to mention, if you want to get something that Tom loves, you'll think of Tom when you see the play. So I want to recommend both of those productions. Thanks again, Tom. I've taken enough of your time, so I should sign off. See you in April.
Thank you, Gene. Great talking as always. I appreciate it. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.